Hello and welcome to Geeking New Podcast. I'm Jeremy Pappas, alongside, as always, at long last, it's Russell Jones. Russell.
Long and last. Those are two things that I would not necessarily use to describe me, but, you know.
Really? Think about what you're saying.
Long lasting, maybe.
Okay. All right. But
you know, like, you might, like gum?
You might and, want, like, yeah. No. Never mind. I'm not even going to continue that any further than it's already. It's been 2 weeks since we've had a podcast. We had a bunch of stuff come up that we just couldn't avoid. So we kind of took a little bit of a break. I'm sure everyone missed all of us greatly. But there's one thing that will bring us back to a podcast. And that's a little Spider-Man news. It was widely reported today. It was widely reported over the last week. This article that I think originally I saw in Variety, but it quotes a couple of different sources. Some of the guys behind the current Spider-Man movie, the Amazing Spider-Man franchise, including noted comic legend Avi Arad, talking about what they're gonna do with the Spider-Mans going forward. We are expecting to enjoy the Amazing Spider-Man 2, which is coming out at the beginning of May. But they're talking about other movies. They're talking about a movie specifically for Venom, which is interesting. They're talking about a movie specifically for the Sinister Six, which is also interesting.
Very interesting.
And then continuing on with the old Spider-Man stuff. The thing I really like, and I'm going to link this article on the podcast page, so I suggest you go give it a read. One thing that I really like, first of all, there are kind of two big things here that you can take away. First of all, is what we have taken to term the Spideyverse.
Yeah.
They say pretty specifically that they're going to sort of make this a Spider-Man cinematic universe. Now, obviously, everything sort of comes back to Spider-Man, but with doing a Venom film, with doing a Sinister Six film, that may not even include Spider-Man in them.
Yeah, which would be crazy, right?
Exactly. See, you know, I think in the last podcast, we talked about letting people do movies that they want to do. That's the only way you get good movies. This kind of smacks of that. I have to say, if someone... I know if you went to a traditional movie theater or movie studio and said, hey, we want to make a movie all about villains, they'd go get the fuck out. just GTFO. Right out the door, right there. But the fact that they're saying, hey, you know what? We are going to do a Venom movie. We are going to do a Sinister Six movie. They're even talking about making the characters of Venom and the members of the Sinister Six a lot more complex than we get even in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Now, with the exception of Loki, the villains in the Marvel Cinematic Universe are all pretty universally bad.
Oh, yes.
I mean, there are a couple of little exceptions here and there, and Loki, obviously. But the bad guys are pretty bad. You're not really sympathetic to Obadiah in Iron Man. You're not really sympathetic to the guy behind the Mandarin in Iron Man 3.
I mean, Trevor.
Well,
you know.
No, the guy behind the Mandarin, not Trevor.
Yeah.
He was just. I consider him quote unquote the Mandarin, but the guy behind the Mandarin, who did the. I wish I could remember the name of the shit because I watch Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and they've dealt with it several times. It's like Serpentis or whatever the hell it is. I can't remember.
Oh, the centipede thing?
Yeah, the centipede thing.
Centipede, yeah.
That whole thing. You know, you didn't root for Red Skull in the original Captain America movie. But they're villains. Well, this, they're saying things like, well, you know, Venom wasn't really a bad guy. He was very morally ambiguous. And Avi Arad is talking to SFX, which is somebody, which is something. It's a UK kind of nerd magazine, I guess. And he says Venom hated only one guy, and that's Spider-Man. Which is true if you're talking about Eddie Brock's Spider-Man, even Flash Thompson's Spider-Man. They're pretty good people. They just kind of get in with the symbiote. They fall in with the wrong crowd, and all of a sudden this dislike, this hatred they have for the one guy is making them do stuff that maybe they wouldn't normally be you know, with some exceptions. They
I would quibble with the they're pretty good guys. I don't know if Eddie Brock and
they're not terrible. They're not super evil guys.
Yeah, they make bad decisions.
They make very bad decisions, but
they typically have failings. I mean, yes, the Marvel Universe is a lot about, you know, heroes with failings, right. But these are guys who have very obvious flaws and failings that would normally be like the cautionary tale side person in a story that wind up like, oh, I need to juice up. I need to get, you know, the shortcut to power. Oh, hey, evil symbiote from an alien, whatever. Okay.
I'll use that.
That sounds like a good idea to, you know, doing the things that I, you know, want to do.
Maybe I can help people do it. It's the Darth Vadering of the guys. But there's history in this where in the original, in Star Wars, I don't think there really was a ton. You know, you look at something like the first Amazing Spider-Man movie, and it kind of bears it out. It says the Lizard, who was the main villain in the Amazing Spider-Man, actually repented at the end in a certain way.
Yeah.
You look at the trailers we've seen for Amazing Spider-Man 2, Electro, at the very least, doesn't seem like a bad guy. He doesn't start out as a bad guy.
No, he's definitely going to be very super sympathetic.
He has a very... I know Rhino was also in this movie. He has a very Rhino-esque quality to him, which we can, I guess, expect from Rhino, too. That whole don't call me names and that thing that makes him angry, and he sort of loses control of his temper. So it's interesting that they're going for more of a Shades of Grey universe than we're seeing with a more black, white, and a little bit of gray for Marvel. So there's that's interesting, and the fact that they're just making it a universe in general is I think something that not a lot of people expected.
You know, honestly, let's look at it this way. The Spider-Man, you know, movie rights are held by one studio.
Yes.
That is not Disney and Marvel, you know, so we won't necessarily see that universe folded back in with, say, the other, like, Marvel Prime, the Avengers, and all that other stuff anytime soon. So really, what choices are we left with? Endless reboots, or the decision of someone to come along and say, hey, you know what? Fine. You want to keep making Spider-Man movies? God damn it, we're going to make a good Spider-Man movies. And they're going to be about more than just the same, you know, the same person, Spider-Man, that is endlessly rebooted into new and new people until next thing you know, it's Doctor Who Spider-Man. That's not how this franchise works.
Yeah, I mean, everyone has been expecting, and, you know, us as well, have sort of been expecting the DC universe. It's always DC versus Marvel. DC's quote-unquote universe hasn't really gotten off the ground. Shocker of shockers. Marvel's universe is very much off the ground, but I don't think anyone's really been talking about the sort of other two much smaller, but still elephants in the room, which are X-Men and Spider-Man. Both Marvel, but both X-Men and Fantastic Four are both owned by Fox. Yes. And Spider-Man's owned by Sony. Their parent companies, whatever they are. So it's interesting that we almost have this four-banger competition now. It's Marvel, Marvel 2, and Marvel 3.
Yep.
Versus DC. Though I guess with films like Watchmen and just the random DC movies that have been coming out, Catwoman and the Batman films, the Nolan Batman films, there's a little bit of gray there. But it's interesting, we could genuinely see four different comic universes: Marvel, X-Men, Spider-Man, and DC.
Oh, easily. And honestly, comic books are already making that work with the way that they put out their stories and universes anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the people who typically enjoy comic books, they are used to that kind of fragmentation to begin with. Like, you have one set of heroes that are in one imprint. Mm-hmm. You have another set of heroes that are in a totally different universe. You have, you know, Spider-Man occasionally has crossovers and was on the Avengers Adults a thing. But he's not, you know, there are Avengers comics and they involve these people. And then you have Spider-Man, who is his own separate thing. So that's doable because it's already been demonstrated in other franchise, in other, you know, mediums, that it is absolutely doable and people have adjusted to that. Whereas most of the rest of the, you know, movie watching audience really don't care.
No.
They just go in and they expect to see a good movie.
Right.
The only, you know, the granular stuff are what geeks like us get in about. Here's some interesting numbers from, there was a group called the Geek Twins. They put out a visual representation of all the different movie rights. That's a nice little infographic that you'd go find. But it lists the top five franchises. Avengers is only the fourth of those Marvel franchises.
Mm-hmm.
The ones above it are Iron Man. Yes, its own separate thing.
Mm-hmm.
X-Men on top of that, and then Spider-Man way ahead of all of them. So, and you could say, well, yeah, it's because Spider-Man has had a heck of a lot more movies. They've made a lot more money because there's just been more of them. But when you look at the whole thing of who's got what, you know, Marvel has this whole big shebang of heroes that they're trying to balance all back and forth and left and right. Sony, all they have are Spider-Man and Venom.
Mm-hmm.
So what else are they going to do? If they want to get into this whole tentpole business and they want to start, you know, doing what the other studios are doing and making movies that all surround this one really strong central thing, they're going to have to start expanding. And mm-hmm. the only place that you can go in Spider-Man and really expand out are the villains.
Mm-hmm.
Because
Spider-Man is Spider-Man.
Yeah, he's by himself. There are no sidekicks.
No, there are a few villains come heroes, helper types.
Yep.
And then you can get into characters like Spider-Woman, but we don't know how much of that they really own. I mean, I have a feeling it's very similar to the deal they have with X-Men, which is just sort of this generic... You have X-Men, which is why we're getting, you know, two Wandas and Wanda and Pietros.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, if they're going to tentpole this thing with Spider-Man, they're actually doing it the right way. With the villains, with the Rogues Gallery, getting the Sinister Six in there. And the fact that having the Sinister Six, giving them their own movie, I think allows you to do the Sinister Six. Could you, I mean, look at the clusterfuck that was the third Spider-Man movie from Sony. Just Spider-Man 3. Look at the clusterfuck that movie was, and there were, what, three villains in that total?
Yeah. There was Sandman, there was Venom, there was...
Green Goblin.
Yes.
So there were three.
You had, yeah.
Who, Green Goblin, Hobgoblin, there was Green Goblin. Yeah, again, yeah, for the third time. So there were three. Now, I don't think if you look at that and you see how terrible that was, that anyone is going to greenlight a... Let's do a Spider-Man movie with six villains. They're going to need a little bit of... They're going to need a little bit of a go-ahead push, and I think a Sinister Six movie gives you that. It's really interesting. Now, who are we talking about when we're talking about the Sinister Six? I think it's safe to say, and I may be 100% out of my gourd, but Russell can shout me down if he wishes. I think it's safe to say that it's going to be a combination of the first and second iterations of the characters that were in the first and second iterations of the Sinister Six. The first Sinister Six was Doc Ock, Electro, Sandman, Kraven the Hunter, Mysterio, and Vulture.
Yeah.
The second... was Doc Ock, Electro, Sandman, Hobgoblin, Mysterio, and Vulture. I think we're probably going to find our Sinister Six in that list of people, potentially also adding in Green Goblin.
So let me ask you this. Out of the list,
mm-hmm.
I think we're both on board that Doc Ock is going to be the most obvious one.
Yeah, they have to bring Doc Ock in. The two reasons I think they have to bring Doc Ock in, well, they're pretty obvious, at least to me. One, Doc Ock is Spider-Man's, it's his flagship villain.
Yeah.
When you think Spider-Man, I mean, he kills Emma, he's the guy. No, he doesn't kill Emma, Green Goblin kills Emma.
Yeah, Goblin is kind of the primary villain.
He's the first
villain. But Doc Ock is the
later main villain, the Mary Jane Watt. He's the guy that kidnaps Mary Jane, not May, all the time. He's the guy.
Yeah.
So we have to have Doc Ock. And you look at Spider-Man 2. Spider-Man 2 did crazy money.
Oh, yeah. If you were reading Superior Spider-Man at all, that whole thing. Doc Ock is a much higher profile villain than, you know, most of the others. Out of that list, he's the highest profile.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I would also say that Vulture almost certainly makes an appearance because, whether this was an Easter egg or not, I'm leaning towards not. Mm-hmm. There have been shots from trailers and other production photos of who we assume is the Green Goblin or Norman Osborn walking through portions of Oscorp, and there are, you know, racks and things set off to the side that are obviously other experiments of certain sorts. And one of them is the Vulture wingsuit.
Right.
And it looks like it's going to be a, you know, like a, almost like the Falcon from Winter Soldier.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be an actual suit with wings and, you know, maybe rockets or whatever else.
Right, right.
So I think the Vulture, because they're already hinting at him, gets involved.
I do too.
There is one that I think actually is going to be able to make it, because, and that's unique to kind of the way pop culture is right now. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say that we're going to see a Kraven the Hunter.
Really?
I think Kraven the Hunter
is the guy that is one of the guys I would say we probably wouldn't see.
Perhaps, but let's think a little bit about Kraven. What was one of Kraven's, like, big, you know, gimmicks whenever he was in the comics, whenever he was in the Spider-Man cartoon, you know, which was another place that you saw a lot of Kraven?
Are you getting at the fact that he's Russian?
No.
Okay. It's like, well, because that is what the way you were sort of setting it up there. I was like, is he doing some weird Ukrainian thing? I don't think he was actually Russian. He was whatever their proxy for Russia was, but he talked in a Russian accent. I will get you this matter.
Well, his name is Sergei Kravenov.
Right.
Half-brother of Dmitry Smerdyakov, better known as the Chameleon. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the thing with Kraven, his thing that I always saw him presented as was he was an expert hunter who really reveled in the spotlight and who really reveled in, like, you know, a show following his exploits. That's how I remember.
See, I don't remember the Kraven that I remember, and maybe we just read different books. The Kraven that I remember, he really only had a beef with Spider-Man because he considered Spider-Man to be most dangerous game, and he didn't really crave the spotlight. He wanted to hunt down the Spider-Man to prove that he was the world's greatest hunter.
He's craving the spotlight.
Yeah, all right. He wasn't craving the spotlight. I wish I would have thought of that as a pun, but I didn't.
I didn't even have to set you up for that.
I've never seen him as craving, which is why I think he doesn't necessarily work, because he's the odd man out when it comes to, you know, when it comes to Electro, Sandman, Vulture. He's the odd man out because he's...
It's kind of like, he's a super hunter. Well, okay, what does that give you?
Right.
You know? So... I'm actually checking the history, and he was presented as the host of a TV reality show in the Ultimate Marvel series, and he also shows up in the 2004-2005 Marvel Age Spider-Man. So that's probably where I'm getting it from. But I think that as a reality show hunter and as a spotlight craver, I think that gives him a vehicle for getting involved. Either Spider-Man takes that away from him, or, you know,
I think something honestly, else if that but was going to be the vehicle, it would just be him going after Spider-Man for the glory of it.
Yeah.
Sort of imagine Spider-Man as Osama bin Laden, and he's the guy saying, I'm going to go over there and I'm going to hunt him down and I'm going to get him.
He's a dog the bounty hunter type character.
Right.
That's why I think he gets in.
In my brain, he's a Ted Nugent type character.
Yeah.
Ted Nugent, the current political force, not Ted Nugent Stranglehold, awesome 80s, 70s, 80s cock rocker. Not that guy. The current Nugent.
He's a much more cranky J. Jonah Jameson.
It's
J. Jonah Jameson.
Nugent uses this sort of anti-establishment, anti-the current president thing to make himself more popular. He says inflammatory things. I could see Kraven the Hunter being that same sort of guy, except instead of being a rock and roll guy, he's more of like an outdoorsman, Bear Grylls type, who says, you know what, the Spider-Man's a menace and the police aren't going to do anything about it. I'm going to do it and I'm going to take you along for the ride. Now, here are my sponsors.
And that's someone that J. Jonah Jameson would absolutely get involved, which we haven't. With Amazing, we haven't really seen JJJ, right? They haven't out.
We haven't seen.
And the Bugle is a media entity in this. It's not. It is not just a newspaper. Right. They are doing, you know, TV. You see the Daily Bugle logo, almost like a CNN style logo on, you know, the news reports that are on television about what's happening in Amazing.
Right.
So it makes sense that maybe they want to give this guy some spotlight, and J. Jonah Jameson is like the executive producer or the whoever that's on top of the whole thing.
Right.
And he's like, yeah, absolutely, bring this guy down. And then Kraven doesn't do it. But anyway, there are those elements to his character that I believe give him an in that other people don't. I mean, Electro, right?
Well, Electro, here's the way I look at it. We have to have Doc Ock because you have to.
Yeah.
He's been the leader of the Sinister Six more often than not. I think you have to, for the same reason you said, I think we have to have Vulture. That's two. I think you get Electro because Electro is already in the second movie. I mean, he's there. Why wouldn't you use him again? Right?
Yeah.
So you have Electro. Yeah. Well, I think if they're looking at a Sinister Six movie, they're going to have some villains they don't have to spend a lot of time on. And I think Electro fills that bill. I think we're also going to see either Hobgoblin or Green Goblin, one or the other, because it fits, it makes sense. Because it fits, it makes sense, and it gives them access to Oscorp technology, which is what the whole thing has been sort of, put around.
Yeah.
Then, so you're left with two more. If you're looking from the list, you've got Sandman, Kraven, and Mysterio. Mysterio, I think, works because he could very easily be a rogue Oscorp scientist.
Yeah.
Who created all these things. It's already very technological, so I think Mysterio fits pretty well. Then it's down to Sandman and Kraven. Here's where I don't entirely agree with you, but then again, I also do sort of agree with you. Kraven, I don't think fits all that well, but we've already had Sandman in the third movie, and it was not all that well received.
No. Yeah.
So I could see them say, because we haven't had any of the others with the exception of Doc Ock, but you can't lose Doc Ock. And you can't lose Green Goblin either.
Yeah.
If Venom were a member of the Sinister Six, I would think we wouldn't see Venom either. Because of the same sort of thing, though Venom's getting his own movie.
Yeah, Venom's getting his own movie, and Venom being a part of the Sinister Six just doesn't, I don't think it
doesn't work. He's not the kind of character that goes with people.
Yep.
So I think the toss-up is between Sandman and Kraven. Now, I'm kind of 50-50. I think they could go with Sandman because he has powers. That's the thing with Kraven, is he doesn't really have powers.
But this universe also is much more, so far, grounded in, you know, almost sci-fi style stuff.
Right.
It's not,
which is why, like, I don't think Kraven fits, because he's not. Sandman is much more sci-fi than Kraven is. Because Kraven, unless they do changes to his character, is not... he's nothing more than being a really good hunter. And that's sort of always been his niche, is he's the Spider-Man villain that has no superpowers. Yet yeah, he's still successful.
Although in certain areas he's been, like, grafted with animal DNA or...
Right, he gets superhuman strength,
like a werewolf-ish type of,
things like that, yeah. But that isn't, I would say, central to his character.
Yeah.
I think you could also see, though this isn't on one or two, I think you could also see Rhino coming back from two and taking that sixth spot, which gives them another character that's established that they don't have to explain, leading them to give you Doc Ock, Vulture, and Mysterio as the three that they're really gonna have to push, which I think is doable in a movie.
Yeah.
So I'm of two minds of that sixth person. I'd say I'm about 80% for the five, because you never know what they're going to do. They may decide that the lizard needs to come back. They may decide they need, I don't know, a beetle or overdrive or boomerang or chameleon, even though it'd be weird to have chameleon and not have Kraven.
Yeah,
you know.
I know. Well,
unless they just don't mention that he's Kraven's brother, which they do all the time. But, you know, so I'm not entirely certain, but my thought is that those are the five we're most likely to see. And then one wild card, which I'm kind of leaning toward Rhino. I think they'll bring Rhino back. He'll be there. They don't have to explain him. It'll be at the end of Amazing Spider-Man 2. They'll kind of regroup, and the Rhino and Electro and Norman Osborn, or Harry Osborn, whoever it is at that point.
Right.
Gets together, and they say, hey, or they're brought together by Doc Ock at the end of the movie, maybe like a Sting thing. And then the Sinister Six movie is them getting together and going and getting Mysterio and Vulture and becoming the Sinister Six.
So who's going to be in it is one thing. The question is why also. And I think that there's some interesting ideas, especially with Oscorp being in, you know, mm-hmm. perhaps that the Sinister Six are brought together maybe by the government or maybe by, you know, Oscorp to do things that they don't necessarily want to do. And so you root for them to break free from their control.
Right.
Which I think is a pretty decent.
Yeah. It's definitely got a good anti-hero thing. Maybe we get them training or things along those lines. Stuff like that. But yeah, at the end of the day, they're brought together to do something. They're kind of a black ops team. Their job at the end of the movie, we find out at the end of the movie, is to kill Spider-Man.
Uh-huh. Almost like Suicide Squad style, you know?
In a way. Or, I mean, they might be able to build the movie around people who have real legitimate beefs with Spider-Man.
Yeah.
I mean, Spider-Man is himself a force for good. The thing with Spider-Man is that he's always had, and what revolutionized comic books, is he's flawed. He's done things and failed to do things that would make people hate him. I mean, why does Harry Osborn hate him? Because he killed his dad. Well, he had to kill his dad, but that doesn't mean Harry Osborn has to hate him any less.
Right.
You know? Electro, from just the trailer, we've seen that Electro doesn't like him because he feels like Spider-Man sort of turned his back on him. Or forgot about him. Or didn't save him. I could see, you know, tons of different things. Spider-Man was too late to save my wife. Now I'm the Vulture. You know, something like that. And you get these people together who have legitimate beefs with Spider-Man.
But then how do you make the movie about them and not about Spider-Man? Because that's part of the thing, is that we have, you know, the spin-off movies with Venom or with the Sinister Six. How do you do those without making them flat out, you know, we've got to include Spider-Man. And that means we've got to make Spider-Man a bigger profile because people, you know, go for like an hour to watch Spider-Man show up for 20 minutes and then they leave.
Well, if you're doing the sort of bring them together to do this one shadowy thing that no one ever tells them.
Yeah.
Then all they have to do is come together under the certain auspices of hating Spider-Man, and they find out that that's their job, but they have to train first, they have to do all this other stuff first. You know, maybe you see all that happen as a course of the movie, and it's sort of almost like vignettes. I don't know. There are a couple ways of doing it, I think.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. I think the takeaway from this whole thing is that it's interesting that they're attempting to do this entirely. Yeah. I mean, they're going to do a Venom movie. This is just Venom, not Black Suit Spider-Man, quote unquote, but an actual Venom movie with whoever they decide is going to be Venom, Flash or Eddie or some other unnamed dude. And then you're going to get a Sinister Six movie, which is going to be all about villains with complicated backstories and emotional content and anti-heroes, pro-villains, I guess.
Well, it's going to be like The Expendables, but with Spider-Man villains.
Right, which I don't hate
which
the way
that sounds.
Which
is almost certainly how it was pitched.
I don't hate the way that sounds.
Right.
It could be interesting.
You know, and it's like, it's like Noah. You look at it and it's like, what is this? It's like, well, this was pitched as, so you know the story of Noah, right? What if we did a disaster movie with Noah, which is essentially what it is.
Right. Disaster and the Bible and World of Warcraft.
And people with flaming, yeah, giant sword, yeah. Because I was talking about this with someone who came over last night to play Dungeon World, and there's like, I saw the trailer for that. At some point, someone yells, "Let's storm the Ark!" And they start charging. I was like, "What the heck is this?" It's like, yeah, this is the disaster movie, and this is just, you know, this is the Mad Libs story pieces that they use to fill in the blanks of the disaster movie.
Right. They do a regular disaster movie type deal. They add in an army and battle and magic and
people who are looking, Noah, you know, for a religious experience retelling of Noah. I doubt that you're going to find it.
Though I have seen some trailers that they've produced, theatrical trailers, they don't really make a big deal about all the other stuff.
Yeah.
They kind of make it out to almost be a semi-skewed retelling of the story of Noah that audience might find themselves in the theater to see and be kind of weirded out that there's World of Warcraft stuff going on. Who knows? But that's coming up pretty soon. I think that'll probably be in theaters in the next couple months. Something else we're looking at seeing in the next couple months is summer. The only deadline we've had, completely switching gears, the only deadline we've had for D&D Next has been summer of 2014. So that's coming up here pretty fast. I mean, it's the end of March, getting in close to April. It's starting to get warmer in some places. We're getting summery. So that means we're getting closer to D&D Next. Now, on a personal note, Russell and I have been playing in, well, Russell's been DMing a game that I've been involved in, of D&D Next, based on the playtest documents that we actually just ended this week.
Yep.
Now,
and didn't get really all the way through the campaign.
No, kind of dropped it halfway through. And I think you're gonna see lots of people doing sort of the same thing.
And maybe. And let me caveat this to start off with. I wanted to do some D&D and play some D&D Next just to play, you know, regularly and get prepared for D&D Next being released, because I didn't really have any D&D Next specifically created adventures. We didn't have anyone locally doing encounters. You know, we didn't really have anything else. Ghost of Dragonspear Castle hadn't come out when we started this. So that tells you how long we've been going on. And we have been playing the Shackled City Adventure Path, which I have the big bound Paizo published book of that in my shelf. And so I've been trying to run people through that, doing as much to convert it to D&D Next as possible, just to see how it held up. Because my whole thing that got me interested in D&D Next wasn't so much, oh, it's, you know, all these different mechanical things. It's that I've got quite a lot of third edition adventures that I've never had the chance to fully play through. Like the only 1 to 20 campaign that I have either fully run in 3rd edition D&D, or even in 4th edition D&D, was the Age of Worms Adventure Path from Dungeon Magazine that involved the spawn of Kios, and I played that when we were at Fort Smith, and, you know, we actually made it all the way through the Adventure Path, which was amazing. The Shackled City Adventure Path was also, you know, it's on my shelf. It's something I'd always wanted to go all the way through. We made it about 3/4 of the way through when 3rd edition was still out. So I thought, hey, D&D Next, we can get in, I can switch this stuff around, and we can plow through it because it's supposed to be very, you know, dungeon-oriented and all this other kind of stuff. And we've been going along like that for quite a while. And it's been quite a while because some of those adventures are pretty darn big and the dungeons are huge. So making the conversions, that's part of the reason I wanted to do it, was to see what converting to 3rd edition was like and to see, you know, from 3rd edition to D&D Next. And also just to see kind of what people thought of D&D, D&X in general. And then in the middle of it, Ghost of Dragonspear Castle came out, and I read through that book, and I saw how they had presented dungeons and threats and different things, and it was much, much, much different than 3rd edition was. You face bigger threats sooner, you know, run into things like curses that really hit you guys hard. There's less of an influence on things that were big when Shackle City came out, like diseases and other fiends and things like that that made people get sick. So just recently, having, you know, done as much as we've done in it, we got to about fourth level, and we got to Flood Season, and we got through almost the end of Flood Season, and it's just, honestly, it felt boring.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you guys were feeling the same way.
I mean, it was never boring because we were able to get together, we had a good group, and, you know, you could play with sticks with good people, and it's still gonna be fun.
Oh, yeah, no, we had good people. That's the thing that really killed me, was that I've got, you know, this group is good people.
Mm-hmm. And but the game itself, I don't think anyone was really super invested in it. I mean, it didn't really feel like we were pushing the world forward. It felt to me, because we had to get these wands of control water, and it was very linear. We were really just walking into different rooms, fighting different things, and that was about it. I mean,
and the thing is that a lot of that you couldn't chalk up to the, you know, the adventure path that we were running. And I was trying to stay as faithful as I could to it, making some minor tweaks here and there. But honestly, I didn't spend a whole lot of time, like, redesigning the whole dungeon so that it felt more like a D&D Next style dungeon.
Right.
That had big, big heavies around every corner.
Right.
I tried to do the best I could to make it make sense, but we were running into, you know, just lots of little threats that it felt like just busy work going dungeon to dungeon and clearing people out of those rooms. And again, that can be the adventure design. But having read Ghost of Dragonspear Castle, that design seemed very similar to it.
Mm-hmm.
Very heavily dungeon-oriented, very room-by-room oriented,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I know it's an early adventure in the path, but it's still just... We run into, I think, similar feelings whenever we were playing some of the playtest adventures that have been put out,
mm-hmm.
like the Underworld adventure at Blingdenstone.
Mm-hmm. Worst name for a city ever.
Right. Well, that's Verfnblin for you. You know.
It's the only thing I can remember about Blingdenstone is thinking, but Blingdenstone, really?
It didn't excite. It didn't awake the imagination the way that we have come to really want from games.
And come to expect from, you know... I remember before 4th edition came out thinking, oh, this stuff's really, really cool.
Yeah.
There's a lot of really neat stuff here. There's so much stuff here that I really want to try it all out. And D&D Next just never had that for me. It never had... I mean, I looked at the... Here's my problem... And this has always been my problem with D&D Next from the beginning is, and I've said this a million times, you could fucking etch this on my tombstone. There were problems in 3rd edition that 4th edition solved. When you go into D&D Next, those problems are back. They are problems with the game. We talked about the other day how they were designing the first three levels to be beginner levels, and you're going to do these. Most campaigns are going to start at 3rd level. That's what happened in 3rd edition. That's not a good thing. You know, I don't think it's beyond the scope of reason to think that maybe you should create a game where you start from first, where you can start from first level and move forward. I mean, I know a lot of people complain that you only ever start every game at 3rd level, and you can't get that, you know, beginning hero sort of thing. Instead of trying to make 1st, 2nd, and 3rd level playable and enjoyable, they just made skipping it the thing that you do.
Yeah.
That's like getting in your car, buying a new car, and driving it around for 2 years and enjoying it, and then the air conditioner stopped working. And instead of fixing the air conditioner, you go, this car doesn't have air conditioning! You can roll the windows down! Awesome! What a feature! And keep driving. It's stupid! Yeah. It's stupid. And people say the same thing with Pathfire was blah blah. Pathfire was 3.5 with a couple of the problems fixed.
I'm sorry. Are you saying Pathfinder, the D&D game, or are you talking about Pathfire, the video news service that we both tend to use that often? It was a very weird, considering that we both work in news, and Pathfire is a very specifically program for news video services. I thought it was
Finder.
Very funny.
Sorry, that was a little slip of the tongue there. Pathfinder It's 3.5 with a couple of the issues fixed.
Yeah. And there are things about the Pathfinder system that Paizo does because they really turn on the flavor. And
well, that's the Pathfinder campaign setting.
Exactly. And that's an important...
And hey, I love... The campaign settings are great. I have no problem with the Pathfinder campaign setting. None whatsoever. It's really cool. I mean, there's a god devoted to butterflies, which is weird. But beyond that, I mean, even with that, I love campaign set. I could read campaign settings all day. But having a good campaign setting does not a good system make. And if it's just three, I mean, it's a good system. It's fun if you play it and you like that. But in my opinion, as in other people's opinions, yours included, fourth edition fixed problems and made, in my opinion, a better game experience for everybody at the table than did Pathfinder. Now, if you want to disagree with me, opinions are opinions. You know, they're like assholes. Everyone has one. So, and they smell right.
And the thing, so here's the thing looking at D&D Next. I think that D&D Next is going to be a very solid system for people who look at playing a role-playing game like going through a funhouse or a haunted house. If you want to link a bunch of rooms together, and you want to put things in those rooms that are, you know, fun, challenges, you know, things that you want to just run into in those rooms that are interesting. And you want to play a group of people that go through this fun house or through the haunted house. And they go ooh and they ah and they, you know, pick things up in the different rooms, which is, you know, your typical dungeon crawling. If that's what you want to do with a game, then this is going to be a good experience for that. The DM is going to have tools that they can make solid encounters, and they can link them together, and then the players can run through them, and you know, everyone will have a good time doing that.
Right.
That's really not why I'm playing RPGs right now.
No.
I mean, at one point I kind of was, but right now that's really not what I'm doing. What I'm doing is trying to tell stories. Mm-hmm. What I'm doing is trying to make people excited, and the stuff that they're getting excited about, honestly, is when you give the players agency to do stuff that is crazy and cool and fun.
Right, to go off the rails, to play an organic game.
Yes, and at the moment, too many of the like traditional systems that I'm running into are still a little too rail oriented in terms of like design. Like if I am a fighter, the way that I express my fighterness in the world is almost always going to be through a skill check or through attacking someone with my axe.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's kind of it.
Yeah.
If I'm a wizard, then the way I express myself on the world is going to be primarily through my spells. And when I run out of those spells, or I'm left with, you know, just one or two spells that I can use on a regular basis that are little pew pew pews, then the way I'm expressing myself in the world kind of becomes boring.
Right.
And you can do things to dress that up, but I'm to the point where I'm tired of doing the dress up, you know? I'm tired of doing those little things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the reason why I think both of us sat down and started trying to design our own game system at points, is because we recognized that we were no longer playing the game that we wanted to play.
Right.
And so we wanted to sit down and do things and make the game that we wanted to play. And another part of the reason why I stopped playing D&D Next is because I found a game that is a lot of the things that I have been looking for and that I have wanted to do. And that's Dungeon World. So playing Dungeon World just really highlighted, and running a Dungeon World game more than anything else. Because I've been playing a Dungeon World game for a little bit. And then I decided I want to try to run a game as a one-shot for my group of characters because, you know, they're not here to play Numenera. You know, everyone's not here to play Numenera this week because we tried to do a Numenera because it was kind of on the same kick. And I thought, hey, Numenera's, this is interesting. I kind of want to do this. It's different. And then Dungeon World, I was like, I'll run Dungeon World one shot. And holy cow, the doors got blown off the place. Like at the end of that session, everyone was like, wow, that was fun. Holy crap, we did amazing things.
Mm-hmm.
That was, you know, I was engaged the entire time. Mm-hmm. I wasn't sitting and waiting for my turn to come around. Holy crap, that was awesome.
Right.
And I was like, so how do you guys feel playing Numenera? No. This is it. This is our jam. This is what we are playing.
And you know, I was on Twitter the other day. I've been a lot more active on my personal Twitter here recently. I was on Twitter the other day, and there was a conversation going on about the future of the industry, the future of tabletop role-playing. And I want to say it was Mike Merles and Monty Cook were talking about it. And I'm pretty certain it was Monty Cook. And I'm totally wrong. It was Hellcow and the guy from Sly Flourish.
Our favorite human ever, Keith Baker.
Right.
And the guy who does Critical Hits.
And Keith Baker says, I think the future is people self-publishing their own stuff. Not, you know, not getting in with huge companies and putting stuff in and doing that big thing. But it's freelancers that are self-publishing and creating the games they want to create. And a further fracturing of the base. He said even something along the lines of, I don't think there will ever be another, you know, flagship D&D experience like we had when we were younger, where everyone was playing exactly the same game. I don't think we'll ever have that experience anymore. And you know what?
I absolutely agree with that.
I tend to agree too.
If you'll recall, we spoke with Jonathan Tweet, the designer for 13th Age. Remember that interview we did? And I specifically said in there, because he had said, you know, it's important to keep these people together and playing this. I was like, I disagree. I think that it's better to have lots and lots of different options because it makes it more competitive.
And you know, 13th Age has been getting a lot of press. It's been getting a lot of pub. I've seen it pop up a lot on Twitter.
And they're doing good stuff. Huh. And they do things in that game that specifically, you know, call out and give players agency and really, you know, try to play with a little more open-ended stuff. Like the way that they do their backgrounds, the way that they do skills traditionally is really, really good. And I enjoy that because you can say, you know, instead of just, I know how to pick locks and that is my lockpick skill. Uh-huh. You can say, I was a Callum Sham Thieves Guild rake or member or top story man or something. And that's your background. Mm-hmm. And then any skill that you run across that you can say, well, my time in the Kalimport Thieves Guild taught me how to, you know, slip through places undetected, how to pick locks, how to sweet talk guards while presenting bribes to them without getting caught. You know, little things like that. And then you could put that towards any of that skill check. The downside of it is that people always will try to kind of, like, they say, well, can I use Arcana to intimidate this person?
Right.
You know, they'll try to fit the square peg in the round hole.
Right.
But at the same time, it's a peg that they were at least allowed to shave on for a little while, you know?
Right.
That's part of the thing.
Yeah.
When you're playing Dungeon World, you are encouraged not to look at your sheet for things that you can do. You are encouraged not to specifically say, I want to go up and hack and slash this person. There's a list of moves that can be pulled off, like hack and slash, which is basic your attack, or, you know, defy danger, which is a whole ton of things. It's like, if you could include armor class and saving throws and I don't know, any other kind of check that you could take to avoid danger into one single roll, that's what defy danger is. The only thing is that defy danger changes depending on what you say you're doing. Everything in the game revolves around what you say your character is doing, what the fiction is happening. There are times when you could just flat out say, you're attacking that guy, he had no idea that you were there. You deal damage, move on. You know? Last night we had, there were three characters who were attacking a bandit encampment filled with bandits and a giant-ass fortress. And they're heroes. They got in, and they acted like big damn heroes, and they got in trouble for a couple places. But at one point, the cleric charged a ballista that was being set up and it already fired at them once. There are like five guys around it. And he gets in there and he doesn't do that well. And two of the crew start beating on him with big mallets that they used to move the ballista into place. And so he says, you know what? I just want to run past these guys. I want to get to the two that are trying to load the ballista again and I want to take them out. And I'm like, okay, that's a defy danger roll. You're trying to avoid the two guys that are attacking you, so roll dex, because he said, I just want to slip past them. If he had said, I want to put my shield over my head and I just want to plow through these guys, I would have said, okay, defy danger with your con.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it changes exactly depending on what you say your character is doing. It's that simple and yet that specific. And so he got through them. He didn't roll that well. He rolled about a 7 or an 8, which in a right now when you're rolling in Dungeon World, it's 2d6s plus a mod. So 7, 8, 9 are like the numbers that will show up the most.
Mm-hmm.
And every time that those show up, it's a complication. You get success, but success comes with a price tag. And I say, okay, you're going to have to slip past them, but they deal damage to you. They whack you with their mallets as they go by, and they get a couple free hits in. However, you make it to that loading crew. They weren't expecting you to show up so quickly, and so they had no time to prepare, and they're caught, you know, flat-footed. You just kill them because he rolled damage, and he did enough damage to take them both out. That was done in, like, that long.
Mm-hmm.
If you try to do that in any other system...
Yeah, there are roles, there's individual combat, there are multiple turns involved.
And by the end of the session, you know, at one point, Macy was getting frustrated because she said, I don't know what I want to do, I don't know what I'm doing. But then two or three turns later, she had leapt from behind a zombie that she was hiding behind that was protecting her, grabbed a rope tied to a bear that had been lowered down by the druid, and the druid was still attached to it. So the druid had, like, fallen down the cliff to where she was at. And it grabbed the rope and yelled yip yip at the bear, and the bear dragged them both up back up the cliff.
Hmm.
But they all, you know, they let go of the character sheets. They stopped saying, okay, I'm looking at my attack. What can I attack? I'm looking at my spell list. What can I cast the spell on? They stopped looking at it like that, and they looked on it as the world. Hmm. And they said, I'm in this world. I'm invested. This is what my character would do. This is what I am doing. And when they describe something that triggers a move, I say, okay, that's the move. Go ahead and do it. And that gives them so much more agency than looking at your character sheet and figuring out, okay, I express myself in the world through these two or three different things, you know? And the thing with the system is that when you tell a DM and your players, you know, this... You can do those things in any system. Yes, that's true. But the systems don't approach it from that angle. The systems approach it from, here's your character sheet. Here's your monster manual. Here are all these things. And all of them are meant to winnow and focus.
Right.
On those specific elements so that they can mathematically represent themselves on a sheet. And you can plow through, you know, kind of like a math problem. Kind of like solving a complex equation.
Mm-hmm.
You have X enemies with Y variable abilities divided over Z number of adventurers.
Right, you have to take what the person said. In a traditional role-playing environment, you take what the person said and convert it into what your character can actually do. And in a system that's a lot more open, a lot more storytelling system, your character can do whatever. There, it gives you a way of basically mathematicizing what your character is attempting to do, taking into concept what they're good at, taking into concept what their backgrounds are, and giving you a result that you feel that is fair. And
but it's just
you're
like,
seeing a lot of those things a lot more often in games that are much more open. It's kind of interesting. In the beginnings of D&D, you played with Theater of the Mind. There weren't a whole lot of minis involved.
And then
it started off as a minis game, and then it became no minis, and then we've been playing minis again for quite a while.
Right.
And now things are starting to go kind of no minis again.
It's starting to get more open slightly, and they are doing several things with D&D Next to try to open that up. And I'm not saying that D&D Next is a flat out, you know, oh, it doesn't allow this, it doesn't blah, blah, blah.
Right.
I'm just saying that
at the end of the day, we don't know what D&D Next itself is going to be and is going to come out of yet. I think we have
a
glimpse of an idea, but I don't think we know as much as even Wizards would like us to believe we know, which is kind of good.
The statue is standing off in the corner of the gallery.
Mm.
The cover is still over it.
Right.
We have been shown little hints and glimpses here and there as it was being chiseled, but we still don't know exactly what the thing looks like yet, and we won't until it flat out releases.
Right. I think when we come to the heart of this is that sort of is that conversation that I saw on Twitter, is that sort of fracturing of the base. And with more self-publishing, with more people putting their own game systems out there, with more people putting their own campaign settings out there, you're going to get more options for people not in... It's funny, I've always talked about how I like character options, and I like to be able to choose this and this, and I don't like to be boxed into characters. it, you have to take it so broad as to give you options of sets of options.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what this, I think this whole thing represents, and why I think it's where the industry is headed, where you're going to see things like Dungeon World, like Numenera, like 13th Age, like Pathfinder, like D&D Next. D&D is not the arbiter of all things role-playing, and I don't think they will be again for quite a while, if ever at all. They're going to be a fish in a pond of other fish. It's going to be a slightly larger fish because they have the name D&D, and everyone knows that we're going to play D&D. And when somebody who you're talking to says, oh, what are you doing this evening? And you're okay with telling them you're going to play a tabletop role-playing game, but you know they're not going to understand that, you're going to tell them, oh, yeah, I'm sort of like playing D&D. Because it's what people understand it to be. So it's yep. sort of has that background, that gravitas. But as far as the actual inside industry is concerned, I think D&D, unless Next is something completely different and it really starts grabbing people from all areas, that's the best case scenario, I think, that Wizards is looking for. It's probably not going to happen. So we're looking at this expansion, which is cool because it means you can find things like Dungeon World and Numenera and 13th Age and any of the multitude of other systems that are out there that really fits the way you want to play, and you're not that weird guy who plays that game that no one else knows anything about.
Yeah.
And you're not the only person you know that plays that system. And I know that's one of the big reasons that I historically have sort of avoided those sort of indie game systems, because to me it kind of flies in the face of it being a hobby, because if it's a hobby that you want to share with other people, those other people have to already share it. It's hard to make it a hobby if you're saying, oh, well, I want to play, you know, a White Dragon role playing 2300 and no one else has ever heard of it. Well, it's up to you to find a group, teach them the thing, basically yeah. to expand your own hobby. Whereas if you're playing D&D, whereas if you're playing something, primarily in my case, D&D, people already know, and they already have backgrounds, are already interested, and it makes it easier. But with things changing the way they're changing, I think that's only really a benefit to the hobby and the industry as a whole, which I really like. I think it's a good thing.
I would say yes, and especially because, so if you're looking at it as a closed system, there are just a flat number of role-playing game players in the world. Then fracturing of the base looks bad for someone like D&D. They're getting a smaller slice of the pie. However, they have the biggest name recognition out of any mm-hmm. almost any brand ever. You know, I mean, yeah, Band-Aids, but it's that level. You know, when you say role playing games, like you're saying, you think D&D, mm-hmm. and they're the ones who make D&D. And if you can be the entryway, and you can get new people involved. And then as new people get involved and they play it for a bit, you know, they're buying your stuff, right?
Right.
And then they say, oh, hey, here are all these other things. And then they go off and they do something else. Mm-hmm. You know, they still bought your books. They still gave you money.
Yeah.
If you can be that entry, if you can be the gateway drug, then
we all start somewhere.
Yeah. Then that would be amazing. Mm-hmm. That would be a way that you can keep yourself relevant and afloat, as long as you can, you know, continue to be the guy who says, you want to play? Come right in. We'll teach you how to play.
And I think that's the best case scenario for D&D.
Exactly.
And for Wizards as a company.
And that's my problem with some of the Pathfinder base, is that they're playing this because it's not D&D.
Well, right.
It actually is.
It is.
Guess what?
Well,
it is.
We've made that argument so many times now.
Right.
That it's 3.5 D&D. It didn't fix all the problems. It fixed a couple of them, but it's still the same system. So regardless, we are now officially out of time. We don't have a specific release date. I'm sure we'll be getting one in the next couple of weeks. For it coming up. One thing I wanted to remind everybody about is this Tuesday on ABC, Marvel Studios is doing their sort of first television special, Marvel Assembling a Universe. If you're interested in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, you should probably tune in. It looks really interesting, and I don't work for ABC. It looks interesting, behind-the-scenes stuff, some looks at Agents of, or from some looks at what we're seeing coming forward with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which had their very best episode last week, I feel. Some more looks at Guardians of the Galaxy, Winter Soldier, but who cares, that's coming out in a couple of weeks anyway, and some more for Age of Ultron. I will definitely be watching, and we'll probably talk about it on the podcast next week. But just keep in mind, and maybe tune that in or throw it on your DVR. But for now, as always, our music is Outprov featuring Esset. Check them out on uhort.no. Check us out on Twitter. We are at GIR Podcast. I said I was more active on there, and it's true. Hit me up. Let's talk about this, especially if you love Pathfinder and you hate my guts now. That's all good. You can also shoot me an email to girpodcast@gmail.com. For Russell, this is Jeremy. Thanks for listening.
Reach the end of the podcast. Stretching before you is just hours and hours of untold silence. What do you do?